Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Beckett, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 4th of June, these are our main stories. Doctors in Sudan say at least 30 people have been killed in the capital, Khartoum, after the security forces opened fire on unarmed protesters. President Trump says Mexico should immediately stop the flow of drugs and migrants to the US border as a sign of good faith with Washington. A Swiss court has suspended a ruling obliging the South African athlete, Caster Semenya, to take testosterone-reducing medication. Also in this podcast,
what the scientists tried to achieve was to provide protection against HIV, but there were consequences to the way they went about it.
New research suggests that Chinese twins who underwent gene editing before birth will now have a shorter life expectancy. Doctors in Sudan say at least 30 people were killed in the capital, Khartoum, on Monday when security forces opened fire on unarmed protesters. State media is reporting that Sudan's public prosecutor has set up a committee to investigate. Earlier, the African Union condemned the violence and urged other countries to refrain from interfering. This man, who wants to remain anonymous, told the BBC that his friend died.
They are running behind us like animals and shooting. They are using tear gas, and one of my friends, he's 22 years old. They're shooting him at his head, and even they are not allowed us to help them. You know, there is many people there that need help, but we could not do anything.
Eyewitness videos showed militiamen beating the protesters and burning their tents. Fadia also managed to escape the violence.
They will kill more people. I don't think this will stop. These militias are unstoppable. And you know about their violations in Darfur of killing and burning civilians and burning villages. So they're doing the exact same thing here right now in Khartoum. The clue is they're killing people. They're killing people. What does that mean to you? They want to get rid of them. So when they kill, means they want to stop the revolution.
The demonstrators had been demanding that the transitional military council run by generals cede authority over the country to a civilian government as Sudan moves towards democratic rule. But the negotiations have become deadlocked, and now opposition groups have broken all contact with the military council. The Sudanese Professionals Association, which leads the protest movement, called for total civil disobedience, a general strike to topple the military council. One demonstrator at the sit-in said the rapid support force may have cleared the square, but they won't clear Sudan. I spoke to our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, and asked him how close the rapid support force was to the transitional military council.
The number two in the transitional military council is a man called Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, and he's also known as Hemeti. He is in charge of the rapid support forces, and it's worth mentioning that this group came out of the Janjaweed. It merged into this RSF group. It carried out a lot of atrocities in the Darfur region going right back to 2003. It's a notorious group. It's possible that there were other members of the armed forces that also took part during the attack on the protesters early on Monday. But what's really becoming clear is that this man, Hemeti, as he's known, is although he's the number two in the Transitional Military Council, he's really seems to be in charge, and he's pushing himself forward. He's the man who went across the region drumming up support, along with the number one in the military council, and he's been the real public face of the military. And that's angered a lot of Sudanese people who, you know, for months pushed to try and get rid of President Omar al-Bashir, and the last thing they wanted after he was gone was to find themselves being ruled by a man who is accused of carrying out appalling human rights atrocities in the Darfur region, and certainly not the change that they've been pushing for.
Given what you described, the question now is, how could this play out?
Well, I think the big question is, are people going to continue to take to the streets despite the fact that it seems the military is not going to give up power. They're still open to consultations with the opposition leaders and the protest leaders about this transfer of power, but it's quite clear they're not going to hand over to civilians. It's also clear from what happened earlier on Monday that some elements of the military are prepared to give orders for protesters to be shot dead, unarmed protesters. So what we don't know is whether people are still going to be willing to heed these calls for a general strike and to kind of shut down Khartoum and other cities, because, you know, the stakes are extremely high and the chance of there being a lot more bloodshed is very high if people take to the streets.
Will Ross. Earlier in the day, the British ambassador in Sudan, Irfan Sadiq, tweeted this from Khartoum. Extremely concerned by the heavy gunfire I've been hearing over the last hour from my residents and reports that Sudanese security forces are attacking the protest sit-in site, resulting in casualties. No excuse for any such attack. This must stop now. My colleague Paul Henley spoke to the ambassador shortly afterwards.
So this is a hugely worrying and negative development. I was woken at about 5 o'clock this morning by the sound of heavy gunfire very close to my residence and feared that this is what many had been warning of for some time, that there will be an attempt by the security forces to forcibly disperse the protest site.
What role, if any, can diplomats play in this?
So our ability to directly influence the decisions of the military council and those who are in charge in Sudan is not apparently sort of clear and obvious. We have some channels into them. I've met them 3 times. I've been in contact with the foreign ministry today to try to urge them to open channels to the military council. But speaking to diplomats isn't their top priority. So we've been making statements through the media. The foreign secretary has issued a statement. You saw my statement earlier, urging an end to the violence, making clear that the military council is responsible for security in Sudan and will be handled accountable if this doesn't stop.
The international community has been pretty quiet so far on events in Sudan generally. How important do you think a strong condemnation of this violence will be from the international community?
We've had a clear condemnation from the UK through our foreign minister. I hope that there'll be statements from the Troika, and there's been a statement from the EU as well. So I think there's a fairly clear international consensus that this is an unacceptable act. There'd also been a fairly clear consensus in the international community, from the African Union, even the Gulf states, as well as Western countries, that there needed to be a swift transition to civilian rule. And that's what this whole process had been waiting for. And we've been pressing and urging for this to happen as soon as possible, because we're all conscious of the risks that would continue if there was an absence of an agreement, the risks to stability and security. And we've seen those risks play out in the streets of Khartoum today.
The British ambassador in Sudan, Irfan Sadiq. Mexico's Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard has warned that tariffs President Trump has threatened to impose could make it more difficult to reduce the number of migrants passing through his country. Here's Barbara Plettusher.
Mr. Ebrard was speaking at the start of a busy and crucial week. In great detail, he outlined all the ways that Mexico had been taking action to stem the tide of migrants over the past 5 months. He claimed that without these efforts, an additional 250,000 migrants could arrive at the U.S. border this year. But he said Mexico believed the only way to stop the flow was to improve economic conditions in the Central American countries from which they were coming. He said Mr. Trump's proposed tariffs and his decision to cancel aid to these countries could cause economic and financial instability, which would reduce Mexico's capacity to deal with migration flows.
Barbara Plett-Usher. President Trump is currently thousands of kilometres from Mexico on a 3-day visit to the United Kingdom. Britain's royal family has hosted Mr. Trump with customary pomp at the start of the trip that's likely to be marked by extensive protests. He's only the third US leader to be accorded a state visit during Queen Elizabeth's 67-year reign. The Queen opened the banquet with a toast to the friendship between the US and the UK. Queen Elizabeth stressed the importance of international institutions forged in the aftermath of the Second World War, such as the United Nations and NATO. Earlier, President Trump paid tribute to Queen Elizabeth as embodying the spirit of dignity and duty of the British people. As the state dinner was taking place, Razia Iqbal was outside Buckingham Palace, where several hundred protesters were gathered. A larger protest is planned for Tuesday. To find out more about those protests, Razia spoke to Saista Aziz, a councillor with the opposition Labour Party in Oxford and one of the Stop Trump coalition organisers.
We are organising this protest because we want Donald Trump to understand that we reject his politics, we reject what his administration stands for. There's absolutely nothing normal about this president in any way, shape, way or form. And so it's really important for us to be able to show solidarity with all the people who are being attacked through his presidency, migrants, refugees, trans people, gay people. The list goes on and on and on. Last year when he came, there was a brilliant protest. It was loud, it was diverse, it was humorous. Those images went around the world. And it really gave people a boost.
How successful do you think the protests are going to be tomorrow? Because the ones tonight are much smaller already. We know that.
Yeah. So I think in many ways the protests have already been successful because the fact that I'm speaking to you, the fact that my colleagues have been able to present a different version of what Donald Trump wants people to hear about him. You can hear some of the noise outside here. Yes, the crowds aren't big, but, you know, without a doubt, he knows, the President of America knows, that there are lots of people who simply reject what he stands for. And by the way, these people aren't just in Britain, these are people around the world. So when we announced that we were going to organise a protest, we had so many people contact us, including Americans, saying thank you for the solidarity. This is a really tough time for us. We're talking about trans people reaching out to us, migrants, refugees, many other groups of people who feel under siege. And they just said to us, listen, we from the bottom of our hearts, we thank you for doing this.
A group of international lawyers has asked the International Criminal Court to prosecute the European Union for crimes against humanity towards migrants in the Mediterranean Sea. Our Europe editor is Mike Sanders.
The lawyers claim that the EU sacrificed migrants to dissuade others. They say that when sea rescue charities stepped in, the EU hired the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept and hold migrants in facilities akin to concentration camps in Libya. A Dutch organisation that collates Coast Guard figures says more than 27,000 migrants have drowned trying to get to Europe since 1993, nearly half of them in the past 5 years. The EU said it hadn't seen the lawyers' file, but said it was people traffickers, not the EU, that caused such tragedies.
Mike Sanders. For millions, it's the way to store your music and audio on your computer, laptop and smartphone. But now, after 18 years, Apple is turning off iTunes.
The future of Apple Music, or iTunes, is not one app, but three. Apple Music, Apple Podcasts and Apple TV.
The announcement was made at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference in San Jose, California. The BBC's technology reporter, Zoe Kleinman, told me why Apple is pressing the off button.
What we're seeing here is a kind of evolution, really, where iTunes is being dissolved, if you like, into three key areas: Apple Music, Apple Podcasts and Apple TV. Now, this kind of makes sense if you think back to the landscape when iTunes launched in 2001. You know, that was before the iPhone. The way we were consuming music was very different. We didn't have 4G. Streaming for long periods of time was very difficult. Now, that's become default. It's become the norm. Apple is already trying to reversion itself as a service led rather than a hardware-led company. And this is part of that. Now, it's worth mentioning that if you've got iTunes running on a Windows platform, then it won't change for you. It will remain as it is.
And what else is Apple coming up with?
Apple announced the new operating system, iOS 13, that will come out later this year. Everyone got excited about it having dark mode, so you'll be able to see a black screen and white text. People get really excited about this sort of thing. It also announced new privacy measures. It's now saying it wants to clamp down on the data that third-party apps can get about you. So, you know, sometimes you open an app and it says, oh, do you want to log in with Facebook or do you want to log in with Google? Well, it's going to create its own sign-in with Apple ID. By doing that, you won't be giving any of your other data to these apps. In addition, you'll be able to hide your email address. So Apple will scramble and make up an email address for you that will redirect to your actual email, but the apps won't know what your real address is. And it also said it's going to stop apps from tracking you. You'll be able to opt out of that. You'll be able to get the apps to ask every single time they want to know where you are. And it'll also stop them doing little tricks, like sometimes they can look at which Wi-Fi you're on or which Bluetooth you're near, and they can triangulate that way saying, work out where you are. Well, Apple's saying, no, we're going to block all of that. We're not going to let those apps anywhere near you.
Zoe Kleinman. Here on the Global News, we bring you the news that's happening right now. But what about the stories that are no longer in the news? Well, that's where Witness History Podcast comes in. 5 days a week, the team brings you history told by the people who were there. Recently, we've heard from the Argentine opera singer who survived when a British submarine sunk his ship during the Falklands War, and then the first black woman to write a Broadway show. The Witness History Podcast gives you a sense of how the news stories of today can have a real-life impact on the futures of the people involved. Just search for Witness History wherever you found this podcast. On the night of June the 3rd, 1989, the Chinese government sent tanks and soldiers into Beijing's Tiananmen Square to crush a peaceful pro-democracy student protest. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, were killed. No full official figure has ever been published, as 30 years on, the events of that night remain shrouded in a blanket of censorship. But as John Sudworth reports, despite the best efforts of the authorities to dismiss the protests as a disturbance, their violent suppression continues to cast a long shadow over the political landscape today.
It was the night that the Chinese army turned its guns on the Chinese people. Hundreds, possibly thousands, of peaceful protesters calling for freedom and democratic reform were killed. Thirty years on, in a tiny two-room apartment in Beijing, Pastor Xu Yonghai is leading his congregation in prayer. He had joined the protesters in Tiananmen Square back then, but he was not just a Christian, he was a trained doctor too.
From the west, the sound of gunshots came. People were shot down. I went to Yodian Hospital and stitched wounds from midnight to 5 a.m. One young kid had a big hole in the arm, the other big hole in the neck. I went home that day with blood all over my hands.
His church draws the dispossessed and marginalized, some of those who've lost land or livelihoods in the wake of China's massive, often corrupt, 30-year rush for development. Mr. Xu, as a result of his activism, has lost his doctor's license. These days, the portrait of Chairman Mao smiles down on the honour guard at the daily flag-raising ceremony. It serves as a constant reminder that this giant square has been reclaimed as the symbolic centre of Communist Party power.
My name is Bao Tong. I am a counter-revolutionary.
82-year-old Bao Tong is a former senior official who had a ringside view of the political turmoil in 1989. Just before the hardliners sent in the tanks, he was arrested, seen as one of those too sympathetic to the protesters, and he spent 7 years in solitary confinement.
What disappoints me is that for the past 30 years, China's leaders have been willing to stand alongside the inhumane crime of June the 4th. They treat it as a valuable lesson, as a magic trick behind the rise of the nation.
The official narrative that the killings helped to keep chaos and revolution at bay is a nonsense, he says. If the protesters had been listened to, China's development may have followed a very different path.
I see a China without a great firewall, without a privileged class, unfortunately with fewer billionaires, but a place in which the poor migrant workers could live freely without being driven out of the cities. I see a China that doesn't need to steal foreign technology.
After our interview, Mr. Bao, who is constantly followed and monitored, was warned not to accept further interviews. If anything, the censorship is growing more intense. Songs that mention the events of 1989 are banned, and people who try to commemorate what happened are jailed. Tiananmen is more than just history. It overshadows everything, as the moment the Communist Party decided to hold on to power at all costs.
That report by John Sodworth. American scientists say that a highly controversial gene editing procedure performed by a researcher on twin babies in China, which was designed to protect the youngsters against HIV, may in fact shorten their lives. They've been examining the potential consequences of Fu Jianhui's work on the gene CCR5. He made headlines across the world and was roundly condemned when he carried out a procedure that is banned in most countries. Here he is announcing the experiment last November.
This surgery removed the doorway through which HIV entered to infect people. No gene was changed except the one to prevent HIV infection. The girls are safe, healthy as any other babies.
Our health correspondent James Gallagher told me about the implications of the Chinese procedure.
What the scientists tried to achieve was to provide protection against HIV, but there were consequences to the way they went about it. And what the study shows is that that was resulting in shorter life expectancy.
But it was controversial at the time that it was done, the gene editing.
Absolutely. These two twin girls, Lulu and Nana, were the first gene-edited babies anywhere in the world. And it came as a complete surprise, bypassing the laws in China, bypassing ethical or scientific consensus. It caused a massive uproar. Words like monstrous experiments were being thrown around at the time when it came out in November, and an investigation by Chinese authorities showed that Professor Hu Jianhui, well, they concluded that he was in this for fame and fortune.
Because
basically,
it wasn't done in response to a medical need.
No, absolutely. There are some genetic disorders where you can argue, look, this child is going to be born with a genetic problem, so let's try to correct that defect before they're born so nothing happens later in life. That's absolutely not what they were doing here. They were trying to give the children added benefits to protect them from a potential future HIV infection. So these were completely normal, healthy embryos that were experimented upon to alter their DNA to give them protection against HIV, because there is a mutation that is quite rare, but about 1% of people in Northern Europe have it. Everywhere else in the world, it's incredibly rare, barely even that many people. But basically, then if you are exposed to HIV, you don't actually get infected with it. So it is useful in that sense, and that's what they were trying to replicate in the study. However, a bunch of other researchers went, well, this gene exists in the human body for a reason. Let's actually have a look at the bigger picture here. So they went to this study of more than 400,000 people in the UK who have had all of their DNA deeply analysed and they've been followed for decades. And they basically went, right, what happens to people who are naturally born, not gene edited, but naturally born with a mutated version of this gene? And they showed that they were 20% less likely to reach their 78th birthday. So essentially, they're dying younger than people with the unmutated form of this gene.
And how does all of this debate affect the wider concerns about gene editing? Where does it go from here?
It shows scientists that are thinking about doing something like this that you can't think very narrowly, right, this gene does this, and that's what I'm trying to solve as a problem. What else is it doing in the human body? Kind of like, what's the much, much bigger picture? And I think it's going to make people be a lot more careful before they ever attempt to do something like this in the future.
Our health correspondent, James Gallagher. A court in Switzerland has ruled that the South African athlete Caster Semenya is not obliged to take testosterone-reducing medication to allow her to compete in certain running events. The Olympic 800 metres champion will now be able to continue to compete without restriction in the female category while her appeal is pending. Here's Alex Capstick.
A statement released from Caster Semenya's legal team says the ruling forcing her to suppress her natural levels of testosterone has been suspended with immediate effect. Last month, the Olympic champion lost a landmark case after the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which is based in Switzerland, agreed with the IAAF, which had said athletes with differences of sexual development had an unfair advantage in certain female events. Her next race is scheduled to be at a meeting near Paris next week.
Alex Capstick. A battered chess piece bought for just over $6 and kept for half a century in a drawer by a family in the Scottish capital of Edinburgh has turned out to be part of a missing medieval set worth up to $1.2 million. The family is said to be amazed that their much-loved trinket of a warrior carved from walrus ivory was actually a piece from the Lewis Chessmen sets, which dates back to around the 12th century and is extremely valuable. Karen Giannone asked the BBC's Beth Timmins about the find.
It's one of the most significant finds of medieval Europe. And this one is, as you said, it's a Lewis Warder. So that is the equivalent to the modern rook on the chessboard. Really interestingly, he's quite weather-beaten and has one eye missing. So this one has been in a family drawer for the last 50 years. But these warders, like this one with the beard, and they often carry shields and swords. Some of them are even based on the legendary Norse warriors known as berserkers, and that's where we get our modern word berserk from, to go mad with rage. So these are some of the most formidable of the chess pieces.
So it must have been the most incredible surprise when this was discovered just sitting in a drawer.
Exactly. So it was actually bought by a Scottish antique dealer from another dealer for just £5 back in the 1960s. So to be worth £1 million now is quite extraordinary.
How do they know it's the genuine article? What goes on now to kind of verify that?
So the family who have remained unknown until now brought it into the auction house Sotheby's for a free valuation, and they've been working on it for 6 months to try and authenticate the find. So they believe that the lines and scoring on the outside of the piece could actually have been made by a plant when it was buried under the sand dune in the Isle of Lewis with the other pieces. So that sort of ages it as well.
And there are still several missing pieces out there. Someone's got them somewhere, presumably.
Exactly. So there's still a knight and there's still three other of the warders, or the rooks. So who knows where they could be right now. I'm sure lots of people will be looking around car boot sales trying to find them. So yeah, it's a very exciting find.
Beth Timmins there. Great story. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Tanya Beckett. Until next time, goodbye.